Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the Haunted Collection. I'm your host, Kevin Kane, writer, paranormal investigator, and haunted collector. I trust you all had a happy Halloween last week. I know I had a great time dressing up, handing out candy to the little kitties, and giving them a little bit of a fright, but not too bad. I didn't have a lot of activity as far as paranormal in my house this year, but there's always next year. So welcome back to another storytelling session where I share with you my favorite horror, paranormal, and urban legend tales. I've selected a couple tonight that I think you'll find very interesting. I've always loved listening to storytelling growing up, and my favorite was always ghost stories. But I also love a good urban legend, especially those creepy ones. Those diabolical ones that have that creepy ending that make you wonder, is this real or isn't it? There are a lot of stories out there like that. Probably every neighborhood has its own story. My neighborhood had the story of the red velvet housecoat, just like I shared last week. If you didn't hear that, please be sure to go back and listen to it. Tonight, I'm going to share another urban legend. The death car. You probably know that there are very few bargains to be had nowadays. Paul and Marion Fowler had certainly never expected to find one while looking for a used car. They didn't have much money to spend, and looking for a good cheap used car can be a pretty discouraging experience. As soon as they told a salesman how much, really how little, they could afford, they were immediately ushered to the back of the lot and left to wander among the heaps and wrecks that were in their price range. Most of these sad remains of automobiles looked as if they might actually have to be towed off the lot. The experience was particularly discouraging for Paul, because he was a real car buff. His old car, which he had nursed along for years, had finally and forever given up the ghost. A new baby and a low-paying job made anything but a cheap second-hand car out of the question. But Paul hadn't fully realized how much car prices had risen and how little his money would buy until he and Marion began looking. They couldn't wait forever either because they really needed a car. Paul had just about decided he was going to settle for the next car that came along that he could afford. Forget looks, forget comfort, forget gas mileage. They needed a car. These were desperate times. They stopped at a large used car dealer on the other side of town. The salesman approached them with a big grin on his face. Used car salesmen always grinned at Paul until he told them how much he could spend. Paul told the salesman, but the salesman never lost his grin. "Well, how about that car?" said the salesman, pointing toward a gleaming, deep maroon Mercedes. Paul glared at the salesman. This must be some sort of joke, he thought. "All right, I suppose it hasn't got an engine, and next thing you'll tell me is that it makes a terrific planner." "Well, the engine's perfect," the salesman grinned. Paul and Marion circled the Mercedes cautiously, as though it might fall to pieces if they so much as touched it. Marion gasped when she looked at the price posted on the windshield, a measly $500. $500 for a Mercedes. That was even less than they had expected to pay. "Well, there must be a catch," Paul whispered to her. "There has to be. I'll bet he won't let me drive it." He turned to the salesman and asked, "Can I give it a test drive?" "Sure," said the salesman, and dangled a set of keys in front of his face. "Take it out for an hour, if you like. Mechanically, it's perfect." The Mercedes drove like a dream. Even in his wildest fantasies, Paul had never expected to be driving anything like it. Marion was practically purring with delight. She could imagine the faces of her neighbors when she drove up in a Mercedes. Her buddy Angela Morton would choke with envy. "Oh, let's get it, Paul, let's get it," she said. Paul, on the other hand, was still suspicious. His life had not been marked by good luck, and he wasn't used to it. "There has to be a catch," he said over and over. "There must be something terribly wrong with this car. What is it, though?" He pulled the car over to a side street and opened the hood. He examined the engine thoroughly. Then he crawled under the car. He did everything but practically take it apart. And he finally conceded that mechanically and structurally, the car was indeed perfect, just like new. "It's probably a come-on," Paul said as they drove back toward the used car lot. "When we get there, they'll tell us that they made a mistake, and the car really cost probably $15,000 or thereabouts." At first he had been wary of buying the Mercedes, and now he knew he would be deeply disappointed if he couldn't get it. As for Marion, she had fallen in love with the sleek maroon machine and would be crushed if the deal fell through. The salesman was waiting for them, still grinning away. "It drives okay," said Paul, trying to sound nonchalant, as though he could take it or leave it. "How much did you say it was?" $500, replied the salesman, beaming away. Slowly, trying not to betray his eagerness, Paul reached for his checkbook, and the deal was completed in a matter of minutes. It was hard to say exactly when the trouble began. For a few days, Paul and Marion basked in the glow of admiration and envy from their neighbors. The remarks about poor gas mileage and the difficulty of getting parts for foreign cars were brushed aside as sour grapes, which they were. Everybody in the neighborhood wanted a ride in the car, and Paul and Marion doled out the privilege, like monarchs distributing coins to the poor. Marion was faintly, almost subconsciously, aware of a strange odor in the car the first time she took it out alone. By the third time she drove alone, the odor could no longer be ignored. The odor was rather hard to describe. It smelled sort of like a piece of meat that had gone bad, but not quite. Marion checked over the inside of the car carefully to see if something had been left to rot, but no, the car was whistle clean. No one else seemed to notice the odor. In fact, when she was out in the car with Paul, or with someone else, there was no smell. But when she drove alone, there it was, and it was getting worse. It became so bad that she practically could not get in the car alone, and she avoided driving by herself. The smell seemed to permeate the entire car, but it was strongest in the trunk. When Marion opened the trunk, the stench was so overpowering that she gagged and almost threw up. While trying to describe the odor to herself, she hit on the phrase, "the odor of death." That's what it seemed to be, the odor of death. Marion didn't talk about the odor with anyone, not even Paul, since no one else seemed aware of it. That worried Marion terribly. Perhaps there was no smell. Perhaps she was going crazy. Perhaps she had a brain tumor. Marion had read somewhere that people with brain tumors sometimes smell things that weren't there. In any event, she had become so wrapped up in her own fears and worries that she failed to notice that Paul, too, had been avoiding the car, and that for days on end, it just sat at the curb. Finally, one night, Marion broke down and confided all of her experiences and fears to her husband. Instead of looking worried, Paul looked immensely relieved. "So it's happened to you too," he said. "Every time I get in the car alone, the smell chokes me. I was afraid to tell anyone. I was afraid they would think I was crazy. I didn't think anyone else could smell it but me." The car had to go back. There was no doubt about that. The very next day, Paul and Marion, together, so that they did not have to put up with the horrible smell, drove the car back to the lot where they had purchased it. The same salesman was there, but he was no longer grinning. He didn't look surprised either. "So you brought it back. I knew that you would. They all bring it back. They can't stand the smell." Only then did the salesman reveal the Mercedes' violent history. The car had belonged to a man who police said was an important member of an organized crime family. One day the man went for a drive and disappeared. His car was discovered 4 weeks later, parked at the airport. The man, or rather his corpse, had been locked in the trunk. He had probably been killed shortly after he disappeared, and his body was left in the trunk. It was July, and a hot July at that. In fact, it was the smell that first brought the car to the attention of the police. The body was badly decayed by the time it was found. The Mercedes itself was sold at a police auction. It was in perfect shape, aside from the smell of the rotting corpse which seemed to cling to it. But after a good thorough cleaning, even that was washed out. The trouble was that every time someone bought the car, the smell seemed to return, but only when a person was driving alone. The car was cleaned repeatedly, but the same thing continued to happen. No matter how low the price, no one would ever keep the car for more than a few weeks. Stories of haunted cars have been floating around our society for many years, many decades. In fact, Stephen King was inspired and wrote the novel Christine based on a demon-possessed car. So, again we come to the question, is this real or just an urban legend? Well, like I mentioned last week, you never know. Sometimes an urban legend just might start from a grain of truth. And I'll leave you to ponder that. Meanwhile, let's move on to our next story for the evening. We return to a college campus. College campus stories seem to be my favorite. It's always creepy. It's always there where you find young people just starting out their lives, trying to get an education. But there's also the dark side of college campuses. Sometimes drugs and alcohol, sometimes something much darker, such as this story I'm about to share, called The Roommate's Death. A college campus can be a pretty sad and lonely place over Christmas vacation. Everybody goes home for the holidays, except for a skeleton crew of local employees and a handful of students who, for one reason or another, can't or won't go home. On the night of December 26, you could walk down Sorority Row at Midwest University and not see a single light on in any of the houses except for one. On the second floor of this one of the larger houses, there was a lighted room. And in the room were three girls, Cindy, Liz, and Terry. Each had her own reasons for remaining on campus over Christmas. Cindy's reason was simple. Her parents had gone to California to visit her brother, whose wife had just had a baby. It was too much trouble and too great an expense for her to join them on the trip to the coast. She didn't relish staying alone in the family house over Christmas, so she elected to stay at the sorority house, though it was to be the first time she had been away from her family for the holidays. Liz had a bigger problem. Her parents were in the middle of a bitter and messy divorce. Thanksgiving at home had been hell, and she was torn and pulled between her mother and father. She decided that it would be better to stay on campus than go through all that again. Perhaps, she thought, by spring matters will have settled down a bit, and then she would be able to see her parents again. The third girl, Terry's, reasons were perhaps the saddest of all. Her mother had died less than a year ago, and her father, in what to Terry seemed like indecent haste, had remarried. The new woman, the girl he had married, was just a few years older than Terry herself. Worse still, Terry knew that her father had been seeing this girl during the months that her mother was slowly and painfully dying of cancer, and that they both had just been waiting for her to die. How horrible. Terry hated them both and swore that she would never speak to either of them. Her mother had left her enough money to finish school, and after that she would set up on her own and banish her father and his new bride from her life forever. Christmas away from home can be rather gloomy under the best of circumstances, and as you might imagine, it was especially so for these three girls. At the start of the holiday, they agreed that for the duration, they would all share a single room, though they had not originally been roommates. They thought that the three of them rattling around that big, empty sorority house in separate rooms would be depressing and just a bit scary, particularly at night. Besides, the sorority president said staying in one room would save electricity and heat. The three girls got on well enough, and they did what they could to make a cheerful Christmas out of it. They even bought a turkey, which they cooked for Christmas dinner. The dinner was only a modest success, for none of the girls had any experience using the kind of institutional-sized kitchen the sorority house possessed. Anyway, there were plenty of leftovers, so they wouldn't have to cook for several days. The night after Christmas, Cindy, Liz, and Terry were up in their room. They decided against going out to the movies because the cold was bitter and a snowstorm was predicted. So they just sat upstairs in their room, reading, talking, and generally trying to ward off the blues. Unfortunately, Liz's favorite way of warding off the blues was eating. She fought a lifetime battle against fat, and since subjected to the pressures brought on by her parents' divorce, she had been steadily losing the battle and gaining weight. Still, she always put up a fight. Liz felt hunger gnawing at her, but she told herself she wasn't really hungry, that she was eating to fill an emotional need. Emotional or not, her stomach was growling and her thoughts constantly turned toward the pieces of cold turkey in the refrigerator downstairs. Finally, after about half an hour of fidgeting, she decided to hell with it. Things had been lousy and she couldn't fight all the battles at once. When spring came, she would diet, for now that delicious turkey awaited her. "I'm hungry. Anybody want to go with me to get a turkey sandwich downstairs?" she asked. "Sure," said Cindy. "Turkey is always better the second day anyway." Terry was just the opposite of Liz. She was rail thin, and when she got depressed, she lost what little appetite she normally possessed, and she was depressed now. "No thanks, I couldn't even look at any more turkey." Cindy and Liz headed downstairs toward the kitchen. The house was dark, and the only light switch was on the main floor. Then they heard a loud crash, as though someone had knocked something over in the kitchen. "What was that?" whispered Cindy. "Oh, the cat probably knocked something over," Liz answered. "There isn't any cat in this house." "Oh, well, maybe one got in. What's the matter with you? Are you scared?" "I sure am. I'm not going down there." Liz was a little scared, too, though she would never admit it. A tough exterior was part of her pose. Besides, the thought of that lovely turkey in the refrigerator drew her irresistibly onward. "All right," she said. "You go back to the room. I'll bring a sandwich up for you. You like mayo, right?" Cindy hesitated at the top of the stairs. She heard Liz's footsteps go down the stairs and disappear into the kitchen. A moment later, there was a crash, louder than the first. Cindy bolted into the room and locked the door. The girls waited. Everything was silent. And ominously, there was no sign of Liz. After a few minutes, they got up enough courage to open the door and go to the head of the stairs. "Liz!" they shouted. And then a little louder, "Liz!" There was no reply. Then they heard a faint, scraping sound coming from downstairs in the back, where the kitchen was. That was enough to send the girls rushing back into their room. They locked the door again and even pushed a heavy dresser up against it. And then they waited. The next sound they heard was a thump, 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 as though something was being dragged slowly up the stairs. When it reached the second floor landing, the thumping was replaced by scrape, 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 as if something were dragged down the hall. The sound stopped right in front of the door to their room, and it was followed by the most terrifying sound of all, the sound of something scratching at the door. The scratching went on for what seemed like hours, though in reality, it couldn't have been very long. Cindy and Terry were too terrified to move. Even after the scratching stopped, they were unable to move. Somehow, despite their terror, they must have dozed off at some point, for they were awakened when the grayish light of morning began to filter through the room. The girls looked out the window and saw that snow had fallen that night. They saw a much more welcome sight, the mailman coming up the walk toward the house. They shouted down to him and told him what happened. He said not to worry, that he would run upstairs and check. They heard the footsteps pounding up the stairs and then stop. "It's all right," he shouted in a rather strained voice. "Everything's all right. Just stay where you are. Don't come out." But they didn't hear all that he said, for as soon as they heard "all right," they began pushing the dresser away from the door, overjoyed at being released from their prison of fear. They threw open the door, and they found Liz. She was lying directly in front of the door in a pool of her own blood. A bloody trail led to the stairs. Her throat had been cut from ear to ear. That's why she was unable to answer when they called to her. But she had not died immediately, and somehow she had had the strength to drag herself all the way up the stairs to the room where her friends were. Her fingers were all bloody too. That had happened as she used the last of her ebbing strength to scratch at the door in a desperate attempt to be let in. If they had opened the door in time, her life might have been saved. And the story ends there, on that creepy note. Who was downstairs waiting for Liz? And were they still hiding down below? I love those creepy college campus stories, and love sharing them. Hopefully I'll have more in the future. I also like that there's a little bit of hint of Thanksgiving and Christmas in there, because Thanksgiving and Christmas are just around the corner, so I'll be sharing some more holiday stories too. This was just to whet your appetite. So, my friends, we'll end this episode of The Haunted Collection, and I shall bid you once again happy hauntings until next week. Have a good night.